on resources, relationships, and learning with Rita Pearson. It's our hope that we're going to provide you with tips and strategies that you can implement in your daily activities with students. But before I get started introducing Rita, I just want to go through a couple of details. As some of you have heard, I have muted the line. We've got about 200 people on the call today. And so we thought, for everyone's enjoyment, we better just mute the whole call. During the call, if you've got any questions, please just email us at questions, with an S on the end, so questions@ahaprocess.com. And I will pose those to Rita when we get to our Q&A time. So let me get started introducing Rita. This is Dr. Rita Pearson of Houston, Texas, and she has been a professional educator since 1972. And she's served in numerous roles, including regular elementary teacher, special education teacher, junior high school teacher, counselor, assistant principal, director, testing coordinator, and consultant. And in addition to all that, she's a licensed professional counselor. As a very experienced consultant, Rita has also presented hundreds of workshops. Now Rita will talk to us about resources, relationships, and learning. Rita, thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and I'm so happy that you've decided to join us for this conference. I have been presenting this material for quite some time, and I'm always elated that there are still more people out there who want to know what it is that we can do with children that would help them to be more productive in the classroom and outside of it. This morning's topic is on resources, it's on relationships, and it's on learning. And the reason we're talking about those three in particular is because the root cause of student success or student failure can usually be linked to those three areas. You know, learning either takes place or it doesn't take place because of resources, and the impact of relationships on learning is even more impactful. So what I wanted to start with was just to dispel a few myths. One of them is this whole thing about relationships. I believe that over the last couple of decades, relationship, just the meaning of the word, has undergone a tremendous shift, and I think it has not been to the positive impact for what we're doing in school. Somewhere along the line, we got relationship and friendship all mixed up. I've heard teachers say, oh, I don't want to be a child's buddy. He's got enough friends. And so a lot of people who really thought they were developing relationships with kids says, oh, well, that's not what I want to do. So in the course of our conversation today, I'm going to try to redefine relationship, because it does not mean buddy. It does not mean having a friendship with a child that puts you guys on the same level. It does mean something entirely different. It is a connection, but it is not the connection that sweetie-feely, huggy-kissy kind of thing that has now been associated with relationships, especially the need for the kind of relationship we're looking for in school that's going to impact learning. So we're going to have a brief discussion momentarily on relational learning and exactly what that means. If you have not looked at the resources piece, Ruby defined in her book a number of years ago that poverty was the extent to which an individual did without resources. And I believe that so many of the difficulties that our children face in the classroom, it can be directly linked to which resources they have, how many they have, and how those resources have been understood by the individuals who teach them and interact with them every day. And for those of you who are not real clear on what those resources are, I'm going to go through them very quickly so that we'll have a chance to take a look at them. Initially, we started with eight, and as we talked about them more, we took the other one from the language piece, the registers of the language piece, and we moved it over to resources to add number nine. The first resource that we look at for determining whether students are going to be successful is financial. Does this child have enough money to purchase what's necessary? Does this child have clothes that he comes to school in? Is he clean? Does he change? Is his hair washed? There are all kinds of visible signs as to whether this child is coming from a household that can take care of the child's needs that are concerning money. And I usually take that a bit further. I want to know how this child reacts to financial resource. If he has money, does he spend all his money at one time? Does he share it with his friends? So it's not always about having money. It's about what you do with the money that you have. And so I pay attention to those things. What do I purchase? What goods and services can I purchase? And so whether you're looking at the child or you're looking at the parent, I think it's important that you know something about this child's financial background. There are those who will say that that's an invasion of privacy. My point of view is that if I don't know that you're coming from a household that can afford to feed you, if I don't know that you're coming from a household with a mom or dad that can't afford to clothe you, I need to know that so that I know what to do in terms of intervention at the school level. The most important one on the list of nine is the emotional resource, and that may not be anybody else's personal choice, but it is mine, because that is the one that says that I can choose and control my responses to my outbursts, to whether it's a negative situation or not. Can I keep myself from engaging in self-destructive behavior? And what I'm hearing from teachers so many times is that I have kids who are hot under the collar, they fly off the handle with the least bit of provocation, that these are kids who cannot take confrontation of any kind. When a teacher tries to reprimand or correct, there's an explosion right there on the scene. And so children who cannot or who do not possess the emotional resource are often those kids who are suspended. They are going to be further behind academically. They have a very difficult time interacting with teachers and other peers. This resource is internal. In other words, it's something on the inside of you. And it usually manifests itself through the use of stamina, perseverance, and choice. If I can make good choices, as an intervention, I often say to teachers to let the children make choices from choices that you've already deemed appropriate. For example, do you want to read at 9 o'clock or 9:30 when you've already decided that 9 and 9:30 work for you? But children have to have an opportunity to practice making good choices, or they become emotional cripples. They cannot make decisions later in life, and they don't have the stamina to withstand disappointment. In a lot of new programs right now, there are methods out there that says, oh, all the children will win. We don't want any kid to feel like he's not valued. Instead of giving a first place, a second place, a third place, or honorable mention, we'll just give everybody a trophy. And that idea sounds good, but it does not help kids to deal with disappointment. And so often, children who can't deal with disappointment, they don't have a strong enough emotional resource, grow into adults who cannot understand disappointment or handle it, and often become volatile and criminal as a result. So I think there's two sides to that. Mental resource is the third one, and it talks about the ability to read, write, and compute. And those babies in your classroom, and I call all kids babies, so whether you teach high school or elementary, they're all babies. But those babies who don't have a developed mental resource will often become your behavior problems. It is better to be, one of the hidden rules I mention all the time, that it is better to be seen as bad and tough instead of dumb. And that is what many kids equate not being on grade level as being dumb. And so they will act out or be disruptive in class when the mental resource is not present. And you will also see this occur in parents when you send notes home or you don't get a response back very quickly, or the response is not legible or it's not well written. Then the mental resource is missing there. Many of those parents will tell you they didn't get the note, or their response to the note is often surprising to the teacher. Spiritual resource is a belief in divine purpose and guidance. In other words, we're talking about hope here. I usually define this one as optimism. So many of our children now seem to be hopeless. They don't think that they're going to do well. They'll say, well, I'm doing the best I can, when really they don't try. Very few have even thought of a future story. Decades ago, there was always some dialogue about what do you want to be when you grow up? And I'm hearing fewer and fewer teachers asking that question, and even fewer children even discussing what's going to go beyond today. So the belief that you have hope, the belief that things are going to get better, the things that you want to do later in life, must be reintroduced or introduced for the first time so that kids will have some hope of doing better than they're doing right now. One of my kids got a failing grade on a 20-question quiz once, and I gave him +2 as opposed to -18. And he said, Dr. Pearson, is this an F? And I said, well, yeah, it is. He said, well, then why'd you put a smiley face? And I said, well, because I want you to have hope that if you got 2 right, you certainly are going to get more right than that next time. Don't you agree? And he said, I never thought about it like that. So anytime we can give children hope and give them a plan for developing a better future story, that's a resource that is most certainly invaluable. The physical resource is the one that says that you have health and mobility. And since inclusion is such a huge part of our instructional day now, we are dealing now with kids who are hearing impaired, visually impaired, and they're immersed in regular ed settings. We're also dealing with kids who don't feel well. We've got the poorer you are, the less likely you are to be healthy most of the time. I've had children with chronic toothaches, chronic earaches, and even though they may not have a special education label, they're not physically healthy, and it is very difficult to learn or to be a part of a group when you are not feeling well. And you can't put yourself physically in the space you want to be in. That's what we're talking about with mobility. Do you have a support system? Support system is right up there with emotional resource. Having an adult who cares about you, somebody that can back you up and is available to you and accessible in time of need. And as any individual, whether you're an adult or a child, if that resource is not a part of your cadre, then you are going to miss some very important details in your life. There will be times when you cannot handle it by yourself. There are times when children need friends to back them up. A lot of our kids, especially those that have kind of dropped through the proverbial cracks, we find that they have no friends. They don't have any. Some kids come to school alone. They don't talk to anybody the entire day. They get on the bus and they're alone, and they get home and there's the aloneness again. So it now becomes our responsibility as educators to pay closer attention to see if those kids have an attachment to somebody that is positive, nurturing. That person can be an adult, and that person is also a peer. In other words, you need both. Having a role model, an adult who is accessible, is extremely important. We have for many years thought that the role model in a child's life would be a parent. But as we all know, every parent is not a good parent. So it doesn't really matter if you got a mom at home or a dad at home, then they're not, and they're destructive and they don't engage in positive behavior. Then where then does the child go? Here's my deal. I believe that teachers become role models and we nurture relationships by default. We have to, because we cannot assume that there's an adult on the outside of the schoolhouse that will assume that role. In other words, we become role models by default, and if you think that's not true, just try changing something or doing something different. Kids are very quick to bring it to our attention. They watch us, they talk to us, and they want to make sure that we are, in other words, in line. And so I find myself often, you know, talking to kids that I'm not teaching at that hour or that I don't have never taught before, sometimes they want to come in and talk. They want to be in my presence. And I know that some of you out there listening have the same deal. So you are a role model, even though that's not your title. Do you understand, this is number 8, do you understand the hidden rules of your campus? Do you understand the hidden rules of the community? Do you understand the hidden rules of the children you teach? And for those of you who have not heard any of this before, a hidden rule is a cue that lets people know you belong here, that you understand the people here. And you give yourself away by your mannerisms, by your dialogue, by your conversations. People will know whether you actually belong or you are trying to belong by the number of questions you ask and where you put yourself. I find a lot of hidden rules just by listening to students' conversations. I find out what's important to them, what's not. I shop in neighborhoods where the schools are located so I get a feel for the community and what they find important. If I don't know my students, if I don't know that community, then just having my academic background is not enough to guarantee that I can help this kid be more successful. And finally, number 9 is, do I have enough language skills to navigate school? And that will take you back up to the mental resource and whether I can read, write, and compute. Do I have the ability to use standard grammar, accurate word choice, sentence syntax when necessary? My mother was a teacher, and when I told her about this formal register, she said, oh, that's code switching. That's when kids talk one way in school and they talk another way with their friends. That's exactly what I'm talking about. What we have now is an era of kids who are shortening everything. They text, they're into hip-hop, they abbreviate. And if that is your sole method of communication, at some point school is going to be difficult. Work is going to be difficult. It is essential that you have the vocabulary of the task you're doing and that you have the ability to negotiate when necessary. And negotiation often doesn't happen because kids have no vocabulary to talk about their feelings or the work that they've been assigned. Kids will immediately fight because fighting is much easier than talking. I've heard teachers say, go out in the hallway and talk it over, and the students will walk outside and just glare at each other because they don't have enough vocabulary to actually have a discussion. So those, in a nutshell, are the 9 resources that are necessary if you're going to be successful at school or work. Now, here's what's important. None of us, adult or child, none of us have, as a rule, all 9 functioning at the same time. We may have 6 going today and 7 going tomorrow, and especially close to payday, that financial resource is going to sometimes be missing. But since a lot of what I just discussed is about attitude, you have the future hope of knowing that things will change. Many of our kids don't have that. If you are, and this is a rule of thumb, it's not written anywhere and it's not signed in stone and blood, but here's what we found. That if you are operating with 3 resources or less, most of the time you're in trouble. And so what I want you to take back from the resources piece is that we indeed go back and look at and attempt as closely as possible to do an analysis on the students we service. What resources do they have today? What resources do they have most of the time? How can I intervene based on the resources that are present? Is this child tardy because he doesn't have a support system? Is this child not doing well in class because he can't read the book? We've got to understand which resources are present. Do you have a student who is absolutely on top of what's going on in the community, knows everything that's going on, he's able to handle and diffuse situations? Well, more than likely, he's got a real strong handle on the hidden rules of the community and of the group. And many times, students can become our allies because they teach us the rules for the group. So from this resources piece, I want you to look very carefully at what you plan to do in determining resource bases for your kids. Referrals to the office should often be accompanied by what this child's resources are. Sometimes we're asking students to perform tasks that are impossible because the resource base is not broad enough. Now, here's my take on that. Because a child does not have a required resource, or one of the nine, or the one that he needs to perform a task is missing, that does not mean we dismiss the task. It does not mean that we get so overwhelmed with sympathy for this child that we say, oh, poor baby, his father's incarcerated, his mom's drug addicted, so we won't ask him to spell. That is not what I'm saying. I am saying that we insist on high expectations. We insist on students doing better, but we provide a backup plan. I know this resource is missing, so what I'm going to do is try to make sure that I provide a setting that you can perform in. If you're not getting your homework done, then I'm going to allow you to stay after school. I'm not going to stop giving homework. I'm going to give you an opportunity to get it done at school. If you are not getting along with other class members and you've not been physically violent, then I'm going to make sure you're working within in a group that you can learn, where you can learn some relationship skills. I'm not going to just sit you in a corner and say, because you can't play with everybody else, you don't get to sit with everybody else. I need to give you the tool for becoming or for developing the resource that is missing. So don't write it off, and don't get compassion and sympathy mixed up. I care about you, but I don't feel so sorry for you that I don't require that you perform. So that ends the discussion on resources, and I want to go into now the dialogue on relationships. Relationships are going to take two forms, and let me tell you what they are. And Ruby talks about them in the form of capital. She says, in our lives, we need two pieces of capital. You need some bridging capital, and you need bonding capital. Bridging capital is our relationship with people that can help us do better. Whether you're an adult or a child, you need some bridging capital. You need somebody that's going to help you get ahead, to help you do more, to help you become more excellent. The real pull is to stay with people who do exactly as you do, who agree with you, who always want to do the same things that you want to do. And that's not a bad thing. You also need bonding capital, and those are people that think like you. They like doing what you'd like to do, and everybody needs some of that. But if you exclusively choose one or the other, or you have one without the other, it makes it difficult for you to become the person you could be. So in our quest for intellectual growth, we need both. We need bonding capital, and we need bridging capital. In our schools right now, there are several groups of people, and this has just been so amazing for me to realize. We are all different generations. In a schoolhouse, you've got a bunch of different people. You've got old teachers. You've got young teachers. You've got teachers who are almost old, and you've got teachers who are still old, but they act young. We just got all kinds of people. So Ruby broke these down into cycles or groups, and let me tell you what they are. Any individual who was born between 1925 and 1945, and some of those people are still in our schoolhouses, those individuals grew up in what we call a silent era. When an adult spoke, they listened. There was no question. You just did it, and if you went outside of what you were told to do, you were seen as a rebel. You were often seen as a troublemaker, and many times you were outcast or put out of the group, or you were not allowed to participate. So the folks born in that silent era are having a real difficult time with today's children. If you were born between 1946 and 1964, you are a boomer. I'm a boomer. And boomers were not quite as silent, but we still had adults who told us what to do, when to do it, how to do it, but we became more open to discussion. We became more open to dialogue. As a teacher today, I still have trouble with kids who are noisy. I want you to, at some point, sit down and listen to what I have to say. Sometimes when I tell you to do something, it's because I said so. I don't want to get into a lot of discussion about what your rights are because I'm a boomer. I grew up in an era when that was not discussed. Now I'm getting better, but it doesn't mean that I don't have those tendencies. Then you got Generation X. They're at the schoolhouse, too. They're teaching kids. Those are people born between 1965 and 1977. And those individuals grew up at a time when the nation was at rest. We asked lots of questions. We bucked the system. We no longer took things just sitting down. And so if you are a teacher of that era, then you have a little bit more flexibility in your thinking than do the silent generation and do the boomers. We are all in the midst of teaching Generation Y. And Generation Y, those kids born between 1978 and the year 2000, some of those people are teachers, some of those kids are students, and these children are really different. They are the most diverse group. They are very socially conscious. They want to make changes in the world, but they also question authority. They want to do what they want to do, and they want to do it when they want to do it. So because we're so different, our schoolhouses are now chock full of little pockets of people. This group gets along with this group gets along with that one, and sometimes nobody gets along with anybody. We all just get in our own little cliques where we're most comfortable. If we're going to be better at teaching Generation Y, we've got to understand them better. We've got to be less likely to engage in verbal disrespect. We have to insist on relationships of mutual respect, and we have to be more willing to have dialogue and conversation, even though for many of us, especially the silent group and the boomers, we're going to have to listen to conversations that are many times not comfortable for us. But in order to create a safe environment, we've got to be more open to each other. I often talk about whether you're a dog or a cat, and cats are very aloof, and dogs are very free with their love. Cats are vindictive, and dogs just want to be cared about. And in your group, we're trying to build relationships with kids from both groups. And so we've got to know whether you've got a dog or a cat. You've got to know what that group really responds to. And at the same time, they have to know us as well. So it's not all about the teacher understanding the student. It is about the student understanding the teacher as well. Especially at the secondary level, we've got kids who go to five or six different people, and they are forced to develop relationships with a lot of different personalities. The great news is that they can do that. It's very possible for them to take that on. Relational learning takes on the attitude that with a relationship, because I care about you, because I may not have intrinsic motivation yet, but because I have a connection with you, I will learn it. Many times, students, a program won't change, won't develop student achievements. Relationships do. Whether you've got Houghton Mifflin, Harcourt Brace, it doesn't matter. If you've got a teacher who's not willing to make some adjustments in their attitude, and teach kids who are not told, you've got to make some adjustments in yours so we can get along. We never get to the learning piece because the relationship is so damaged. Any teacher that we remember as adults who was excellent and that we can remember what they said, we've taken those practices and those lessons with us into adulthood, every one of those teachers had a relationship with us. So is content, an understanding of your content essential? Absolutely. But is knowing your students even more important? I certainly would say so. So as we look at the resources, as we look at relationships, and as we look at learning, we've got to figure out how to circle that ball together. I need to know what pieces you're functioning with. I need to know how to get closer to you and how to let you get closer to me. It doesn't mean that we'll be huggy, kissy, feely, but it does mean that I understand you, that I know which kids I can raise my voice to and which kids I can't. I know who will be traumatized by getting sent to the board and who I need to lean over and talk to about it privately. Those are relationship-building pieces. Do we have students? Are we insisting that we find small groups that kids can become a part of so that they can build their bonding capital? Is there an adult in this child's life, another friend that this child can get close to so that they can get ahead? Bridging and bonding, capital, is essential in the relationship building piece. Learning is what we're all looking for. Improved attitudes and improved instruction, we're all looking for that. It's how we plan to get there. It does not bear truth that the harder and the more distant you are, the more respect you will get. Mutual respect is not born of verbal disrespect or abuse. It is born between understanding what I have to say and what you have to say and coming together on those two points. I am over by 1 minute, so I will stop here, and we will entertain questions, and we will try to get as much done in the next 30 minutes as possible. Stephanie, are you there?
I am. Thank you so much, Rita. And let me just remind everybody that if you have any questions, go ahead and email them to us at questions@ahaprocess.com. So that's ahaprocess.com. Our first question is, it says, as an elementary building principal, I have battled with tardy students for 24 years. I know that most of the time it is the parents' fault and not the students. I've given out dozens of alarm clocks and talked to parents and the students repeatedly. I have tried recognizing classes that have perfect attendance as well as issuing consequences for those who are tardy. The data shows that strategies have minimal impact at best. Should I just be thankful the students get here at all, or are there other strategies you can suggest?
Here's my next suggestion, because you've already tried quite a number of them. I don't know the kind of community you live in, but it sounds like now we're at the point where we need to do a little legwork. Most of the children in poor neighborhoods go to church. I would be willing to bet there are a number of churches in the neighborhood. The first thing I would do is solicit the support of any outside organization like a church, the Y, any small businesses in the area, and put the pressure on. If ministers always say they want to be an active part of the school, then this is the way they can do it. They can start preaching attendance from the pulpit, tardies from the pulpit, and we can do something that is akin to a political canvassing. Team your teachers up, and we go door to door. We knock on doors, and we talk about what is happening as a result of tardies. We are missing instructional time. I know you want your children to have excellent academic behavior, and this can't happen if they're late for school. We've given out alarm clocks. We've given awards, and I know you care about your kids, and you want to help in this venture. My parents did what was called a fan out, and that's when you take 5 or 10 parents who are active in the school and you get them to call fan out. The fan out could be a phone call, it could be a visit, it could be meeting in the grocery store. But that core group of parents puts it out there. It's like a blitz for however long you want to do it, 4 weeks, 6 weeks. We blitz the tardy thing. We talk about it. No more alarm clocks, because you've already done that. But this is the human approach. We get out there. We talk to the churches. We put parents on the phone to other parents. We visit churches on Sunday. I felt like a politician at one time, because I go to every church or synagogue in the area and let them know what we're trying to do at school. And I said, and if you're a part of this community, you'll put the word out too. Put some pressure on parents to get up and get out. Put some pressure on the older kids to get themselves up. You know, it's unfortunate that support system is going to be missing from them in terms of an adult. But some kids have to actually get themselves to school. But I would start with that on my feet blitz. And I would go to every church, business, organization in the neighborhood and ask them to put pressure on parents to get their kids to school on time, and let parents do a little of the pressuring to other parents in terms of that fan-out approach. I hope that helps.
That's the only question that I have at present, so if there's another point that you want to make, Rita, please go right ahead, because we still have a little bit of time.
On that point, I don't have anything else to offer. I really want teachers to, at some point you start to feel overwhelmed. Principals start to feel overwhelmed. You know, how much more can I do? How much more, you know, involved can I get? And it's one of those questions that doesn't have an answer. You know, you always have to do one more thing. If for any behavior that is bothering you, whether it's about instruction, whether it's about attendance, I would suggest that you make a checklist, a procedures checklist. If your students aren't bringing books to class, you know, I would list that on my paper, and then I'll say, what's my current procedure? What am I doing now for those kids who don't come to my class prepared, or they don't have pencil, or they don't have books? This is what I'm doing now. Is it working? Does it work sometimes? Does it not work others? And then I would solicit the support of the kids themselves. What can we do as a class to improve bringing our pencils to school, bringing paper? And then as a group, we look at it again. We've got to get our real concerns down, specific concerns, and then say, this is what I'm doing now. Is it working? Is it not? This is what I plan to do next time. Something as small as using a pencil sharpener. You know, I say don't sharpen your pencils after 8 o'clock. At 8:09, somebody's at the pencil sharpener. What am I going to do about that? Eating in the classroom. I know at the secondary level that's a huge concern. What's my plan right now? What? How do I handle it now? Am I screaming? Am I upset? Is it doing any good? So anything that is bothering you, no matter how small, list it and list the procedures you're currently using, and then say, this is what I'm doing. Is it working? Is it not? This is what we plan to do. I will involve students in this endeavor, or I will tackle this on my own. How to walk to the lunch room. Cleaning out from under your desk. How do we walk in the hallway? Respecting the teacher's space. Any of those things that come up can be addressed with your checklist. In other words, I want you to write down what's ticking you off. It's kind of like being on a diet where you have to list all the food you're eating so you can determine how many calories you need to cut or add if you're trying to gain weight, although I don't know anybody who is. But you look at what you do now as opposed to what you can do, and then analyze whether that even worked, and then we keep going back to the drawing table over and over until we discover what works.
Great. Thank you, Rita. We had a question that says, can we get this presentation in a handout? And I don't know if you have anything handy, but I know that we are also going to offer your, Rita has two products that we carry. One is called Rita's Stories, and the other one is Teaching on Your Feet. And the Teaching on Your Feet is an audio, so you can listen to that kind of to and from work or something like that. And the Rita Stories is a DVD, and we're offering both of those items at 20% off if you order those in the next couple days.
Now, the resources are listed in every Understanding Poverty series that we have. The resources, those 9 resources that I went over initially, it's in Understanding Poverty, it's in the text. If you've had the workshop, it is also presented in your handout. And so those 9 resources are on the Internet. They're all over the place. And so those will not be difficult to get to. The other pieces I was talking from experience, they are some of the pieces that I mentioned today included on those two products that Stephanie just mentioned. Was there another question before I start something else?
I do have another question.
Okay, go ahead.
At the high school level, what do you do with students who are disruptive, students who refuse to take pictures, for instance, with group photos, or are outright defiant?
Let's start at the beginning. What does your classroom look like? How many students do you have? Do you have a private or a public relationship with the student? Is it one? Is it 5? Is it the whole class? If it is one student, I need to examine, do I have a relationship with this one student? It sounds like it's just one. Students who refuse to participate, I often have a series of mini conferences. That's M-I-N-I. I will find you after class, or I will talk to you at a time when I've arranged with maybe another teacher to talk to you. I'll catch you before school. And I will talk about things that are not even related to school. That is my attempt to develop a relationship. Sometimes I will ask, are you angry? Is there something about the class that you would like to change? Is there somebody in the class that bothers you? If it is just that you are just trying to be disruptive, I cannot continue to tolerate that. So you're going to miss a lot on what we're doing based on your defiance. At the secondary level, it really must be based on relationship. You might want to have a conversation about the perils of disrespect, especially verbal disrespect. Let me find a list here. I think I have it available, of what we can talk about in terms of what verbal disrespect looks like, and then have some discussion on it. While I'm looking for that, let me say something else about an emotional checklist, and this might apply to the question we just got. Students might have these issues. I often can't name the feelings I'm having, or I blame others for my feelings. These are questions we could have the students to go through themselves. It can be private. It's a self-assessment. I lose my temper and yell at other people. I threaten and hit others, and I start fights. This is on page 86 and 87 of the Under-Resourced Learner book, if you want to look at this more carefully. And it sounds like the student that the caller was talking about has some of these issues. I have a negative attitude. I sometimes harm myself physically. I act without thinking. And you could take any one of those subtopics and talk to students in small groups of three or four. And there have been times when I taught high school English that I had to stop teaching class and have a discussion on some of these topics. You know, I start to teach and you start to cut up. And so this is not working. So we need to stop right now and figure out how to fix this. And so there have been times when I devoted 15 to 20 minutes of a class period on clearing up the problem. I did not do a student self-assessment. I wish I had known to do one at the time. And to let kids know that whatever they put on their self-assessment was private between the two of us. I was not going to go out and make it lounge talk. But I think it's important that we let kids get in touch with why they're acting the way they're acting. It might be, and I'm not saying this is true, it might be that it's time to just take a more firm stance in terms of maybe you need to raise your voice a little, maybe you need to be more firm, don't scream. But sometimes kids take advantage of us when they feel like we're soft or we're not going to respond in a certain way. I say shut up and sit down, and you say go to the office, instead of saying can I see you in the hallway. This is my classroom. You cannot disrespect it. I don't disrespect you, and I will not allow you to disrespect me. It may be time for some real firm conversation. And with some of this, I can tell you what you could do, but I can't put it in you to do it. And that's a real tough deal. It's like cooking from scratch. You know how to make it taste good, but you don't know how to make somebody else's cake taste good. So I want you to start with the self-assessment. Do I act without thinking? Do I have a negative attitude? And some of your kids are going to be even defiant about this. No, my attitude's not negative. And so I'll say, well, what are you doing right now? You know, have you been a contributor to this class, or have you been a detractor? Tell me, what do you think you're doing? I can't let you stay here if you're going to continue to not be a participant or a contributor. And I don't believe you want to go where you'd have to go, where you wouldn't be able to say anything, and that's an alternative class or suspension or another placement. So I would try the short discussions first and see if that had any impact. But again, that self-assessment in the URL book might be a good starting place for you.
Rita, I did get update, a follow-up on that question, and the caller said these are upward bound students, pre-college program, and there are one or two students. We find many African-American girls refusing to get into a picture.
Now, upward bound is a college prep program for poor kids who are college bound. It is a very, I used to teach in upward bound. It was once very selective, but not selective. In other words, they took that we took tough kids who had potential to be greater. Mm-hmm. And so it's if this is Upward Bound and it's a program where you're chosen to participate, we need to have some discussion about what kind of program you're in. If you're going to participate in the Upward Bound program, then here are the ideals and goals of Upward Bound. Is this what you really want to do? I believe that it is. So it's not really about the picture. It's about something else. So we need to have some small discussions on what did you want to get out of this program when you came? What did you think it was like? There are some rules for poverty, and there are some rules for middle class, and there are some rules for where you're trying to go. So I'm trying to give you some new rules, and you keep trying to play by the old ones. And if you play the game by the wrong rules, you lose. So that has to be the discussion, that I don't have to keep you. This is a competitive program. People want to do better. If you continue to defy me, it says that you don't really want what I'm offering, and I can't put that in you. So talk to me about what you want. What are your plans? What's your future story? What do you see Upward Bound helping you do? Where do you want to go? Are you going to let me help you get there? It's one of those times, I think, when tough love is really in line here. It's not all, oh, baby, please, come on, sweetie pie, because that's not respected. You don't learn new rules, you lose. You play by your old rules, then what happens is you'll get the same old rule result. And I think we need to say that. All rules, if fighting gets you to the office, do know that if you continue to fight, you stay in the office. Do know if you continue to fight, you continue to lose because school does not recognize that rule. Now, that rule will work on the street because if you fight on the street, it gains you respect. But if you don't know two sets, if you don't know how to have one set of rules for here and another set of rules for a different place, at some point you lose. You got to decide what's more beneficial. Trust me on this side. All I ask is that you give me a little bit of time to teach you a new set of rules. Then you choose whether you want to play by them or not. But while you're here, while you're in my space with my time, with my endeavor at stake, you got to play with me. If you choose not to play, you choose to sit on the bench. You choose not to be in the game.
All right. I've got another question here for you. And that is, how do you coach a Generation X-dominated staff to adapt to the Generation Y students that we serve?
It's a give and take. First of all, we talk about it. I don't believe that many staffs have had the Generation X, Generation Y discussion. And Generation Y, believe it or not, is pretty open to discussion, even at the elementary level. A couple of weeks ago, I talked to some seventh graders about this very thing, and I asked what was the most disturbing for them about their teachers, and the overwhelming response was that they're so old-fashioned. They want us to do everything their way, and they don't like our music, they don't like our clothes, and so I said, well, just for a minute, let's turn ourselves into Generation X people. And then I gave them a lot of characteristics of Generation X. You know, we listen to 45 RPM records, and we like, this is who we like. We like to have words put in complete sentences. And I said, just for a few things, is there any of that stuff you like? And then a couple of kids said, well, you know, some of my mom's old music is really good. And I said, well, can you think of anybody? And one kid said, I like the Temptations. And I said, well, now let's listen to the lyrics. Which one did you like? Because I knew all the lyrics. And they said, I like the way they made this sound like this. You got a kiss so sweet you could have been some honey. And honey is sweet. So we went into a whole thing about a Temptation song. So it begins with having some discussion over what are some characteristics of Y, what are some characteristics of X. Can we come together on some compromise? X can never be Y. Y will never be X. But can we compromise? Can we come to grips with a few of these things? For example, on the sagging pants issue, my rule was you can sag up to 1 inch below your waistline with a belt. You don't have to pull them up to your waistline. You can sag 1 inch below that, but your shirt must be tucked in, and you can wear a belt. That's my compromise on sagging. If you have to hold them to keep them up, that won't work for here. If you want to wear them sagging with no belt, that won't work here. If your shirt tail falls out, that won't work. But I'm willing. I'm willing, because you're Generation Y. I'm willing to go with the sag look. If that's what makes you happy, I have to agree with something, because I rolled my socks down when I was in high school. My mother hated it. She wanted them folded. I rolled my skirt up to make it shorter. She wanted it at the knee. So I remember. I remember that I was once a Y-er, even though I was an X-er. I remember Y behaviors. So at some point, X has to give a little. X doesn't have to give it all, because at that point, Y has to give a little, too. It is about compromise in a confined space. And school is a confined space. So unless there's some compromise, if it is all what I say is my way or the highway, then we immediately turn off the group we're trying to turn around. But if they see we're willing, many kids are willing to give a little as well. Hope that answered you.
Great. The next question we received is, do you create an actual resource list and ask families or students what resources they have?
Actually, you can. You can have, and that is a part of a resource analysis on self. Again, you got to analyze your own stuff. Initially, I found out what resources were present and missing in discussion. I would just have a discussion with kids about things that were related somewhat, but not specifically. And I got a lot of information that way. But in our newer work, especially in Bridges Out of Poverty, parents actually do a resource analysis for themselves, and it is nothing wrong with that. I would suggest that you emphasize that it is confidential and personal, that they don't have to share it with classmates, because many times classmates already know what those resources are for the other kid. But sure, I would have parents to do it, and I would have kids to do it, and I would tell them why we're doing it. We are in a quest to be better. We're in a quest to add to our pot. You know, the more I got in my pot, the better. The more full, I think there's something, fill my bucket. There's a book out about that, something about a bucket. But the more you got in your bucket, the stronger you are. And so resource development is just about filling your bucket. And we need help from each other in bucket filling. So absolutely, do the analysis. First of all, I ask teachers to do an analysis on themselves. And I am amazed. Well, I bring it up during a workshop. I will say some of you are missing emotional resources. You're screaming, you're thumping your feet, you're slamming doors. And at the secondary level, you're cussing a little bit at kids, and then you're wondering why you're not getting the response you want. And then I get a few laughs and going, yeah, that's the truth. So do it on yourself. Have kids to do it themselves. And, you know, a really great activity for them is the dog cat analogy, when they find whether they're dogs or cats. So dog cat assigned with the resource analysis is an excellent activity. And with the dog cat, because I don't think I explained that, you ask them to list all the characteristics of a dog, then all the characteristics of a cat, and you say, ask yourself, which one are you? Put those characteristics with people now and ask yourself, which one are you?
Let's see, those are all the questions that I've received thus far. We've got about another 5 minutes if you've got another point you want to pass on to people.
If you have not looked at your student accountability in terms of, again, a procedural checklist, it may be a good idea to look at that. And let me, before I go into that, let me say this. In terms of developing a better school climate, a more excellent product, meaning the child, one of the things I think we might want to do is consider marrying some of the old school practices with new school ideas. Meaning that I know that we are in an age of technology out of the wazoo, and we have thrown a lot of those old school practices under the bus. But for your kids who are underperforming or who are not performing at all, we may need to bring some of those old school practices back. like handwriting, like oral reading, like sentence dictation so that I can teach you punctuation and sentence structure, like having you to recite for me in a complete sentence, and then take that complete sentence and log it in on your computer. Or instead of your smart board that I think, you know, and I think smart boards are wonderful, maybe you need to pull out your chalkboard or your overhead projector where you can erase it and look at it, and kids can come up and write on it, and you can have some direct instruction teaching on your feet. So in order to get kids to really see the value and importance of this educational endeavor, we may have to go back and do some things that we once did. You know, I might have to walk you home one day after school just so I can get a conference with your mom. I may have to ride that school bus. I may have to do some things that are uncomfortable, and I'm definitely not in my job description. But I have to create a stronger bond with the community, and sometimes I can't do it with those. I can't do it with an email to you because I don't have a computer. I can't do it with texting you because your phone is turned off. So sometimes we got to marry old and new, or we're not going to get anything. Make a list of things that you want to see change in your own particular classroom. Make a list of things that are actually going very, very well in your classroom. Which kids do you get along with well? Which kids seek you out? All of that's resources, relationships, impacting learning. And I think the more we do of those things, the stronger our classrooms are going to be. Is the student neat? Is he not neat? Does he complete his work? Does he not? Make a list of all the things that are going, and then go from your list. I think we become overwhelmed at looking at the big picture all the time, and you don't even know where to start. You don't know where to go first. Your kids are tardy. They're talking out in class. They're being disruptive. And, you know, and so often I hear, boy, that never happened when I was growing up. Well, yeah, it did. We were just more, we cussed, we talked back, we just did it when nobody was looking. So children have not changed, but the adults raising them have, and therein lies our challenge. So many different groups of adults are with our kids that we've got to recognize that some policies and standards have to stay the same, others have to shift, but at all times we must maintain our role as adults. We got to be the big person in the classroom. Being a balanced classroom is great, but sometimes kids are just looking for an adult who will stand up and say, I'm the boss. I have the structure, and I'll keep you safe here, and this is a place where great things happen, but I'm the boss here. There can be no shared democracy in a classroom. Kids have the right to be loved, nurtured, cared about, directed, and taught. They don't have the right to tell you what to do or to be the boss of your space. So while we marry old and new, while we seek to develop and develop stronger relationships and a stronger school, a more collaborative school climate, when the rubber meets the road, children have to be children and adults have to be adults, or the whole thing just goes belly up. You got to run your spot. You got to be in charge of it. And kids have to know that and feel comfortable with it and love you because you care enough about them to challenge their behaviors and activities.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Rita, and thank you for everyone who's joined us on this call today. I'm sure that you are going to walk away with a lot of great tips and great ways to be in your classroom and in your schools. I so appreciate everyone taking the time. And
you know what? It was so, I'm so sad that we only got an hour. My joy would have been to open up those phone lines and let you call and talk to me rather than sending an email. But with so many participants, we couldn't do that. But I certainly hope that some of what I said, because I had no way of knowing that because I'm not dialoguing with anybody, but I hope that something I said would be beneficial. And please feel free to email me with any questions you have. Once we're done, I'm certainly open to further discussion.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, everyone. Until next month. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.